Mere days after his 32nd birthday, on Saturday, October 7th, Chaim Katzman was killed by terrorists from Gaza in his neighbor's home in Kibbutz Cholit while shielding her with his body. He was identified and the family was notified the next day he was buried on Thursday of that week. Born to American immigrant parents and one of six children, Chaim was a scholar of philosophy and earned a PhD in political science. He was active in several local peace organizations, and he was also a musician, mechanic, and a gardener. Chaim's mother, Hannah Wacholder Katzman, a writer and women's rights activist, joined me, Amanda Borchel-Dan, this week in the Times of Israel's Jerusalem office for this week's What Matters Now. As Hannah wrote in an essay for the Times of Israel, I realized early on that because Chaim's death was part of our national story, the mourning would be public. So we talk about her way of openly mourning and how it has helped others with their national grief and of the continuing ripple effect of Chaim's murder on her life. As the world increasingly forgets what spawned the ongoing war in Gaza, we focus on one son and ask his mother what matters now.
The Technion Israel Institute of Technology is where some of Israel's brightest minds ask the biggest question of all. What if? What if they could take on the world's biggest challenges? What if they could develop life-changing environmental, scientific, health, medical, and technological discoveries that will make a huge impact on Israel and the planet? But they don't just ask the question, they answer it too. They turn those ideas into reality. They make them happen. To see just some of the incredible things they've achieved, get the Technion Booklet of Wonders at ats.org/wonders. We hope it inspires you to give them your support so they can keep doing what they do best. The American Technion Society. World-changing discoveries by Israel's brightest minds, made possible by you.
Hannah, thank you so much for joining me in the Jerusalem offices of the Times of Israel today.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
We are here to discuss, of course, your son Chaim, who was murdered on October 7th by terrorists, but also to discuss your life and the ripple effect of the murderous rampage that went through the Gaza envelope on that day and how it is affecting each and every one of us until today. So again, I so appreciate you taking the time from your life to come here and speak openly about what you're going through.
Thank you.
So your son was a very special person. Obviously, you know that. But just to remind our listeners, he was basically the modern equivalent of the kibbutznik Renaissance man. He was the kibbutz gardener. He was also a mechanic at some point. But at the same time, he could equally discuss philosophy and completed a PhD. In fact, he was a teacher. He was a musician, he was a DJ, he was everything all together. It's such a huge package. How did you accept this package as it came to you throughout his life?
Well, Chaim didn't live nearby, so I wasn't fully aware, you know, of his daily routine. I've been wondering about that. You know, when he became a gardener, he told me he was going to quit his job with at the garage in Moshav Dekel in the Gaza envelope. And he was very close to the boss who trained him. And he'd worked there for 5 years or so, and a while he was getting his doctorate. So he said, oh, I'm going to become the gardener of the kibbutz. And at the time, I didn't think too much about it. And afterward, I'm wondering, well, how did he learn to become a gardener? I mean, I knew he was interested. At one stage on my balcony, I had a compost pile, but I'm not, you know, a serious gardener. And so we had talked about it. I knew he was interested, but I think he just learned on his own. And he attended a workshop in Italy. And he also helped establish two community gardens in the Bedouin city of Rahat. And I'm in touch with the people he worked with there. Another thing about Chaim that comes to mind is that he was, the people in Rahat didn't know anything about him. They didn't know that he had a PhD. They didn't know that he was a musician. When he was there, he was focused on what he was doing for them. And he gave them a lot of advice outside of to help them work better, develop a schedule, and get more people interested. So I think that's one of his qualities that I'm realizing now as we're talking, that he was able to focus on what he was doing at the time and give it his full attention.
Right. He had so many disparate spheres, but it appears as the honest bystander that he gave each of these spheres everything. When you look him up online, of course, you see his academic work, and then you can see his writing for Haaretz, which can talk more about his activism, which actually borders along with his academic work. Very interesting confluence, shall we say. But at the same time, you see people talking about him at parties as a DJ and as bringing so much joy to different people. We should remind our listeners that he was 32. He was actually born on my birthday, October 3rd. And so he had just celebrated his 32nd birthday at the time of his death. So young, had packed so much into life. And let's turn to the day of his death. And he was a hero as well. And does that make his sacrifice easier for you, knowing that he saved a life?
Not particularly. To me, it's not. I'm very, very happy that she was saved. If it had been the other way around, I doubt Chaim would have survived. I don't focus on the death. I try to remember his life, and I haven't been down to Chalit. I'm actually planning to go next week. You know, I haven't been down there. I haven't There was a TV show about all of the events in Chalit. I didn't watch it. And I really am in touch with a lot of the people from Chalit, but I, at some point I'll be ready to, but
I so identify with you in a very apples and oranges kind of way. My brother died when I was 20. He was 22. And he died actually in my bedroom because it was on the ground floor, and he was dying very quickly from melanoma. Oh, he was diagnosed and died within a month.
I'm so sorry.
No. Everyone experiences loss. But I couldn't go back into my bedroom for a long time. I couldn't sleep there for years. So you have to go when you're ready. There's no pace, I think. And I think that's maybe what I'd like to hear from you. There's no rule, right? There's, of course, the Jewish law. There's the funeral, the Shiva, the Shloshim, the month after, and then the year. But that's all artificial.
When my mother died, I remember that those stages felt relevant to me. In other words, I felt, you know, a change in how I was processing it at a week, at a month, at a year. This time, not so much. I think that I'm focusing on the memorial for Chaim, and I've spoken a lot about him in different venues. I've been focusing on my own issues. You know, so I'm focusing on my other work. Like, it's certainly better for me. I was at a retreat with in Cyprus, sponsored by Yad Lubanim and the One Family Fund for families of fallen soldiers. Chaim was designated a fallen soldier because he was in the advance guard, the Kitat Konanut. He was, and there were three families of sons who were older, like Chaim, and the rest of the families were the parents of young active soldiers, and mostly of the observation officers, and me and the other parents of the older sons were, we felt we were in a different place than they were. They were processing it. They had a much harder time processing it. Also, our children weren't living at home anymore, so we didn't feel it, you know, in the day-to-day, like you mentioned, going into their room and all that. We didn't have to deal with that. So I know that I'm, you know, moving forward, and I'm, you know, able to enjoy things, and of course the grief hits you, you know, at unexpected times. Purim was just now, and, you know, the beginning of Purim was very hard for me. I was really not in the mood, but by the end of Purim, I was enjoying it, and,
It's interesting how the Jewish calendar forces you in a way, and the calendar in Israel, in a way to get out there again, if you're willing to go with the flow, such as Purim. Of course, Purim is my least favorite holiday because I'm such an introvert and I hate crowds and I hate loud noises and I hate inebriation. It's just...
I think there are two types of people, people who really love Purim and people who don't, and I'm definitely with you. And I'm always... You know, feeling like I want to wear a costume, but I can't decide what to wear a costume, and I can't plan it, and so I never have a costume. And Mishloach Manot.
So stressful.
My daughter was saying last year she didn't do enough, and this year she did too much. And I said, I don't think you can never get it right. It's always both too much and not enough at the same time. So... that didn't change. One of the things I noticed, especially in the period after Chaim's death, was that certain things became easier for me. And specifically speaking in public, I used to be very much afraid of speaking in public. Over the years, I've gotten better. But speaking spontaneously is a lot easier for me than it was before. And there are other things that were hard for me that just got harder. Things that... You know, planning things, for example, you know, dealing with uncomfortable situations, you know, but just you kind of move very slowly, you know, going back to work, it felt like you're in molasses, just like getting your head together to do the work you did before.
Identify as well with that molasses feeling. And I wonder... my mother died 10 years ago as well. And in every loss, you intellectualize it. You understand it on an intellectual level, but sometimes it takes a while to understand it in an emotional or with every cell in your being level. And I wonder when that happened for you with Chaim.
I don't know. I don't even feel I fully processed my mother's death over 30 years ago. I don't know that I'll be able to process it. What I know here that my grief is shared. In other words, the kind of things I'm experiencing, a lot of people are telling me they're having it also, even though they didn't lose a close relative. No, so
because it's such a national mourning, really, until today,
yeah.
Especially at the beginning. And of course, the funeral for Chaim was on Thursday of the same week, which was one of the rather earlier funerals. And I would imagine that the Shiva for many people became this receptacle of grief in a way, in a place where it is okay to be outwardly sad and mourning, because all of us were having that molasses feeling at the very beginning of the war for sure, and not quite understanding where do we go from here. So it's not as if people were using you, I would say, but your Shiva and your very outward mourning, at least in the English-speaking community and surely beyond that, because your son was so enmeshed in so many different worlds, I'm sure was a way for all of us to grieve. Did you have a sense of that too?
Right. So as I wrote, you know, in the blog post in the Times of Israel, you know, I felt that a lot of people who came really needed, like you say, you know, some kind of way to express their grief and their sorrow. And I was there. After that blog post, I got a number of emails, all from people who had lost children. And about four or five people, one of them was a fallen soldier, but the others had died from other circumstances. And one of them said that at the Shiva for, I think it was a 19-year-old who'd been killed in a car accident, that they didn't know what to say. And of course, that's a very common thing. I don't know what to say. Now I'm getting messages. I just want you to know I'm thinking of you. And he said he felt he was comforting them, like he needed, and it's interesting. So I didn't pick up on that at the time, but I think he's right. I had the capacity to do that at that time, you know. So it was okay. When I was at the retreat, one of the other mothers said, they complained about the organizations that come. There are a lot of people, representatives from different organizations came to the different shivas with food, and they would sit and they would try to be helpful. And one of them, she called them the Chanas, which is my name, of course. And they didn't bother me too much. But a lot of people say, you know, can I give you a hug? They want to give you a hug. And so.
And did you want
to? I did, but I don't all the time anymore. Yeah. I realized it's not, you know, always appropriate for me. And it's like you said, it's more for them, which is fine too, but that's okay too. You know, it's just depends on the circumstances, and you know, it's always changing. You just don't know.
For sure. And I know my father and many bereaved fathers have said this, but he said to me even recently, it's just not the natural order to bury your own child. And that it's shattering.
When my father, well, both my parents lived in the U.S. when they died. My father lived to an old age, but my sister called me to tell me that the doctor said that it was imminent. So I called my friend and she said, there's a saying, it's a Chinese saying, grandfather dies, father dies, son dies. And that just, it's a blessing. It's that.
It is a blessing and not all of us are right. Lucky enough to have
right.
That.
Right, I lost my parents. My brother died also about 8 years ago. He was 60, died of cancer. So, you know, so that was also tragic in its own way. It was also very, he was actually, Chaim was, well, people have talked about the resemblance, but he was also very motivated. He was a cancer researcher, actually, for the National Cancer Institute.
It is always difficult when you see glimpses of a family member who has died in the living. And I definitely see that in my oldest son, that he looks so much like my brother. And at the same time, it's really amazing and wonderful to see these. It's chilling, amazing, and wonderful all at the same time. And I imagine you're holding all the emotions all the time. And I know for me, even as I'm reading our obits that we are those we have lost project, which
yes,
is
it's to, a very a beautiful project.
It is. And I'm still crying every night that I'm reading these. I'm still crying because that's okay. It's okay to let out the emotions here and there, of course, in our tough macho country. And are you finding yourself more accepting of your own emotions?
Yes, I was. I talked about spontaneous. I guess I became a celebrity because I signed up to go to an event. It was actually covered in the Times of Israel. My picture is there, but I wasn't mentioned. And so the publicist who planned the event saw my name on the list, and she called me and asked me if I would be willing to speak also. So I said okay, and I cried actually a couple times when I was, but it just doesn't, as I mentioned there, and then I worked as a lactation consultant for many years. I remember one time I got a phone call. I picked up the phone and that they're just, the mother just started crying. Like just the fact of actually hearing the voice of someone who might help her. You know, when I would often go to mothers' houses and they would start to cry, and when they were telling me about their birth or their, you know, experience. And I always felt that was good. That was a sign that they felt comfortable with me and that they had emotions they needed to let out. So that's what how I feel about the crying. I totally accept it whenever, you know, wherever it comes. And I try, I'm writing for my final project for my MA in Ben Gurion in Hebrew literature. I wrote in the creative writing track, I wrote a series of essays, and they're a memoir about my childhood, about different periods of time. And one of the themes is shame, and just like, you know, I write how I grew up feeling shame from a very young age. I think a lot of women have that experience. I don't know where it stemmed from. But one of the things that I work on, you know, is just not to feel shame for things that are, I don't need to feel shame about. I mean, I just remember when I was younger, you know, I remember when I was in second grade, I got glasses, and there was one boy in the class that got glasses, that had glasses, and one day I left my glasses at home, and my mother brought them to me, and I was so embarrassed that somebody would see that I left my glasses at home, just things that were so, and that boy even saw, and he really didn't care, believe it or not, he didn't make fun of me, or I don't know, and that's just an example of, the type of thing that's so that was like really a deep part of me. So being able to stand up and cry and not feel, you know, embarrassed is it's how I try to live.
I got married this Monday in the middle of a war.
You are not a soldier anymore. You are 50 years old. What is the matter with you?
It's like a couple of kilometers from here. Like, my friend has a 4x4. Let's just go cut across the fields and go get him.
Israel Stories, Wartime Diaries. Voices that try to capture slivers of life right now.
And he told me, take with you a sleeping bag and a tent and just go.
I texted him on, like, after I was told that he was killed.
From their eyes, I was a traitor.
Everybody needs their, like, blankie. Their teddy bear, something to make them feel safe.
I'm just another grandfather looking after his grandchild while his son is off at war.
These children of Hamas now will be the killer of my children.
I desperately wanted to talk about sex during my eulogy for Ido.
Everyone has to choose to be optimistic because we don't have room for pessimism.
Check out Israel Story wherever you get your podcasts.
We both come from the United States, and being a parent of a fallen soldier is not exactly an everyday common occurrence there in our generation.
Among Jews,
for sure. But here, it is a status that is recognized and honored. And do you feel that you've transitioned to a different level of status or being Israeli?
Not so much. First of all, he wasn't, you know, it's this technical status, really. You know, he wasn't serving. He would call me. I'm remembering now how I would get calls from the army to the home phone, like recorded messages saying, we're trying to reach Chaim Katzman if this is his number, you know, or he should call, whatever, for Miloim. And I would call Chaim and tell him, and I don't think he did anything.
But that's part of his character, right? This is the same guy who got kicked out of high school and ended up with a PhD, right?
He was a dedicated soldier. I remember there was one operation that he was called to go on Shabbat. They picked him up on Shabbat, and then we saw in the news that there was something, you know, he didn't confirm or deny it. And And, you know, and I also got messages from his commander, one of his commanders. You know, he was, you know, very good soldier and very, you know, he was in the combat unit. But nobody was really actively against war. And his friends were talking about whether he would have put on a uniform now. And his friends said he would. And his friends did. I mean, many of his friends are serving, so.
And he did go out and save his neighbor. So the impulse was there.
Well, oh, that's true. He was trying to say, that is true. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, he cared about the people on the kibbutz and he, yeah, self-defense for sure. I mean, there's an influencer on Instagram who has a video where she says, most people don't know that the majority of the residents of the Gaza envelope were progressive. And then she lists all these different peace initiatives, a Palestinian-Israeli cooperation, and she mentions Chaim, and she shows this picture, and how he went to the South Hebron Hills, and he, where there was typically settler violence, to help deter it and document it. And they mentioned the gardens in Rahat, and he transported children from Gaza to hospitals in the center of the country. He was in Academia Le Shivyon, which is equality in academia for minority groups. And, you know, she made it sound like, you know, like Chaim and other peace activists like him invited Hamas into their house, you know. Chaim had a doctorate in international relations. He knows a lot more about Hamas. He knew a lot more about Hamas than this influencer did who lives in America. And what about, you know, this government? I mean, they were as far from the politics of Chaim as you could be. And somehow it's the fault of Chaim, you know? I mean, it's just really...
People can be shockingly cruel and misguided.
Yeah, so a lot of people sent me that video because they thought it was complimentary to Chaim. They didn't get it.
Yeah. Online, I saw as well that somebody wrote you on Twitter. You had posted something about your son. Oh. And they wrote, what, it's X days after his death and she's already on Twitter?
Yeah, right.
Just people...
Right. Well, that was certainly not the worst thing that people wrote me. But let's say someone said, you know, he shouldn't. What was he doing living there? But, you know, he was living in Israel proper. So, you know, whatever you want to say, obviously, for some people, that's just as bad. It doesn't matter. But
I've thought about this just, you know, in shower thinking. I think you can appreciate that concept. You had six kids, I have, you know, seven, and sometimes and you just can't find the second to think. But in the shower, sometimes you have a minute or two to have a thought, right? And one of my thoughts was, people make so much about the people who have been transporting sick people from Gaza to the hospitals who lived right nearby and were, of course, slaughtered. And as if Hamas could differentiate between these people. They had no idea who was there. Everyone was just a donkey to them. Who knows if the donkey was left wing or right wing? And it's so cruel and misguided to try and pin this massacre on the people who tried to make the world better. It's shocking to me.
Obviously, they don't see it that way.
His work, his academic work, is still in the process of being published, if I'm not mistaken.
Right, that's right. There's still one. There was an article that came out a couple of weeks ago by Morty Miller, and he had written to me on October 9th to tell me that, you know, to express condolences and told me that an article was coming out. And I thanked him, but I must not have read that message carefully. I didn't share it like I shared most similar messages to me. And so I was really surprised when this article came out. There was a special Israel issue in the Politics and Religion, I think it's called, journal. And there's another book chapter coming out from Tel Aviv University. That's going to be in Hebrew about, I think the topic is the Americanization of the Israeli right, which is another topic that Chaim specialized in. And he really, so he really had a deep understanding of current politics, and his doctorate was in international relations, you know, so... You know, to say that he didn't know about Hamas or that he thought Hamas were good guys is just...
Cruel and misguided.
Yeah.
You, like me, you're an immigrant. And I wonder if you feel as though you had the support network that you needed to deal with this loss.
Well, I had a wonderful support network. I can't even... I'm incredibly fortunate. You know, I moved to Jerusalem a year ago by myself, and I already... had friends here who were very, very supportive of me. And when Chaim was killed, I felt it was an intensification of that. It was just more of the same because, you know, I'm used to hosting and cooking, doing all the cooking. And for all those months after I moved here, I was invited. And I said to someone at the time, I feel like everything I did for people, like came all the, every good thing I've done, like came back to me, and I still feel now, you know, after, especially after now, I still feel like I'm still getting a lot from other people, much more than I'm giving, which isn't usually how things work with me, and I keep saying it's okay, it's okay, you know, I'll have time to volunteer again and to help other people, and. I gave myself an exemption from most from military funerals and from many funerals, and you know, just now I've started to go again. But it's
only been 6 months, not even.
Right. Right.
What brings you out of the pit when you're starting to fall into sadness?
Well, I just accept it. I just accept it and say that's okay. I know, you know, get better. I'm basically okay. You know, I know that I'm stable and I'm, you know, and I have friends I can count on and my children. So, and I know I have the support and you know, even without this, sometimes you're lonely. Everyone has times when they're lonely and they're down and they feel bad. So Chaim had a car, 1999 Toyota Corolla.
1999.
Wow. And, you know, as I said, Chaim left home, you know, after he finished the army. And we always had relationship, but it wasn't always close. In recent years, we became, Chaim really made an effort. And when I moved to Jerusalem without a car, and I asked him if he could lend me his car when he went to India. He went to India for 3 months. He held concerts there all over India. My daughter met someone on the beach, an Indian, who had met him.
Crazy.
And so he lent me his car for 3 months. He came back right before Yom Kippur. And he met me in Jerusalem. I gave him back the car. And that was the last time I saw him. And he... So we didn't know what happened to the car afterward. We thought, but it had might have been destroyed, but it was fine. So his boss that I mentioned before
towed
the car. He couldn't find the keys. And I said, maybe Chaim hid them from the terrorists. And that turned out to be correct. When his friends like went to the apartment to collect his personal things, they found them in a hole somewhere. And anyway, he... serviced the car and brought it to me, and I had it. It's very old. When I went into someone else's car recently, I felt like I was going into a 5-star hotel. and I need to clean it out and whatever, but well, it broke down. The gear died. So I had to deal with that. And, you know, and sometimes it's hard to do these things. But again, I just tell myself, you know, it's only a thing. And of course it puts things, you know, Chaim's death puts things in perspective, and I've been able to carry that forward when minor things happen.
After my brother died, he was a soldier actually, in the U.S. Army. And after he died, we divided up his possessions for use. And I just came across the Swiss Army knife that he had as a soldier. And now my twins are going into the Army, one on April 1st and one on April 18th.
Oh.
And so I hope that they'll carry it forward. And I wonder if you mentioned the car, but is there anything else that you hope to carry forward from Chaim?
Well, I think his quality of listening to people and of, you know, being with them, this focus that he had, I hope that I can adopt that. He had very few possessions, actually. He was minimalist, very much so, like many people in Cholit. And, you know, the car was an example of that. You know, they would just find old parts and, you know, use them. You know, and they gave me his personal things. It was like a backpack. You know, there's a diary, which is illegible. I it's very hard to read his handwriting. Someone, you know, I think Chaim's father said, well, do you want to read it? And maybe I don't. I don't know. But I haven't had the focus to do it. You know, he had some things people gave him, his students. One of his students said, I hope you get an appointment as a professor. He really wanted an academic job, but only in Israel. You know, he got a job in offer for 3 years in Athens, Georgia, which he decided not to do. Yeah, so I just hope that his academic work will be read. And, you know, I said it at the unveiling a few weeks ago that we should expect our memories of him to become less intense. That's just how it works. You know, and his academic work will be relevant, but there will be new academic work, and he won't be able to relate to the war and to the after effects. And that's something, you know, that we just need to prepare for. I think what sparked it was somebody was talking about their mother, somebody who had the picture of the dead son, you know, for 30 years, and the son stays young and we get old.
Yes.
And, you know, and I can already feel it. But that's life, and that also hopefully makes it easier. Also, as other things replace the grief and the new memories, positive ones, hopefully.
Amen. Hannah, thank you so much for taking the time with me.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me.
Thanks for listening to What Matters Now. This episode was produced by The Podwaves. If you have any questions or comments on this or any other episode, please drop us an email to podcast@timesofisrael.com. I'm Amanda Borchel-Dan. Until next week, shalom.